Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Across America, people are abandoning small towns and rural areas and flocking, perhaps fleeing, to the city. The result, decaying towns and the decline of rural America. That's the conventional wisdom, but it seems it just isn't true, and it certainly isn't what writers James and Deborah Fallows found as they spent 4 years crisscrossing the nation in a single-engine plane, landing that plane in areas most of us just fly over. What they discovered was a vibrant middle of the country between two coasts that are thriving and which get all the attention. The nation's midsection is acutely aware of its problems, but also busy crafting solutions. As the rest of the country is gridlocked by divisive political points of view, they're rolling up their sleeves to bring positive change. James Fallows has been a national correspondent for The Atlantic for nearly four decades. Deborah Fallows is a linguist who has also written for The Atlantic, as well as National Geographic, Slate, and The New York Times. Together, they have written about their journey to discover what's really happening in small towns in their book, Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. And thanks to UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute, both are with us this morning in our Spirit Square studio. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike. We're delighted to be here.
Thanks, Mike.
Nice to have you
here.
Nice
to see you.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can do so. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, get to us through Facebook at WFAE or through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can watch us this morning on Facebook Live. You spent 4 years, as I said, traveling around America to small and mid-sized towns, and you started planning this, I think, in 2012 and finished your trips beginning at the very beginning of last year. So what gave you, who came up with the idea and why?
Actually, our son came up with the idea.
Really? Wanted to get you out of town, didn't he?
We had recently come back from China, where we had done a lot of traveling around to small towns to just get a sense of the variation and heart of the country. And when we came back to America, we had been away for 4 or 5 years and felt like we were out of touch with what was going on here. So, and we were a little grumpy.
Especially one of us.
Right. And so our son said, why don't you do what you love best? Get in that little plane that you like going around to towns to see things. And why don't you do it like you did in China? Go from place to place to just get a sense of the pulse of the country, what's happening, quote, out there. So we thought, wow, 18 years of raising him, and he came up with a great idea.
Well, James Fallows over here, he's the pilot. He's the guy enamored with small planes. From what I understand, you kind of put up with it. Is that right?
To me, it was functional.
And then it became pleasant
and exotic and a real adventure. It's Jim's passion. And to be a pilot, I think you have to have that passion. It's something you can't not do.
Yeah. You said, Jim, that you began this to take a fresh look at the country, its disappointments, and its possibilities. Did you start with any preconceived notions that proved to be right or wrong, or did you just set out on this trek with an open mind?
It was mainly, you know, everybody has a set of biases and preconceptions, but we thought we were just going out there to see what we would find. One of my mottos about journalism is that reporting is the process of learning what you didn't know until you showed up. Mm-hmm. And so by showing up initially in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, then Rapid City, then Holland, Michigan, places we hadn't spent much time, we just wanted to see what it felt like in those places if you weren't going there to ask, what do you think about Obama? What do you think about George W. Bush? What do you think about Hillary Clinton? But say, what is the saga of Sioux Falls right now? Yeah. We only intended to do this for a little while, but it just became so interesting and so surprising that we kept going and going and going.
Yeah. There are those of us around the table old enough to remember Dinah Shore singing "See the USA in Your Chevrolet."
Right.
Most people don't remember Dinah Shore or that song, but nonetheless, people took her up on that offer and traveled the country by car. Now, it's a car-centric country. You chose to see it by air. What's the difference? What are we missing as we come into these small towns in America by doing it on the ground?
I think there's there's a semi-obvious and a surprising thing you miss by going on the ground, which is how most of us normally have to travel. The semi-obvious thing you miss is there is a stunning beauty of the American landscape from 2,000 or 3,000 feet up, which is the altitude we fly. Not airliner, but
yeah, different from being in an airliner.
Oh, yeah. From an airliner, you're too far away to see anything. But from 2,000 feet up, it's like being on, you know, a sort of rolling Empire State Building that's going around the country. And you can see why cities are where they are, how the streams and the mountains and everything fit. And so I could go on and on at length about that. But I think the other thing that is less obvious is America is more distinctive and different than you would think. Because when you're on a freeway, essentially all freeways look the same. You have your off-ramps and your gas stations and your Applebee's and your Motel 6 or whatever. And it seems like it's one big just strand that is extruded across the whole country. But cities are much more different and much more sort of locally conscious than that, if you can kind of approach them other than from the freeway.
When you were, go ahead.
And one aspect of that Jim wasn't able to enjoy as much as I was because he was busy landing the plane or taking off, was the approach to town is very different from getting off the highway and going down the road, usually with strip malls, and finally you get to a town. When you're in a plane, you can look down at very low altitude, maybe 1,500 feet, 1,000 feet, and see the outline of the town and get a sense. Are the swimming pools above ground or in ground? Are the factories parking lots full of cars, or are they vacant, and are there weeds growing up in the parking lots? And how important is that river to the middle of town? You're like a bird, and the entry to it gives you a different kind of sense of the culture, a different preparation than going past the dollar stores or the local grocery store.
You were writing, we just talked about this for a second, but you write about how from the air you look down and you can see why towns are where they are, because these three rivers come together. That makes sense. Or why mills were put in the Appalachians, because they're all downstream of each other and the water was used to turn the wheel, which made the mill work, and that's why they were all located that way. What does that sense of geography and the understanding of that geographical history do for your understanding of these towns and of America?
I think that it just is satisfying to see all the geography courses or history courses you've ever taken. You can kind of see them laid out in front of you. Flying especially east to west, you can see the centuries of westward movement. You can see the Cumberland Gap. And you can see sort of the shift in the settlement patterns from Ohio and Indiana out towards the real Midwest and Illinois and Iowa, how the farms become squarer when you're in Illinois and Iowa, and then things get drier out beyond the 100th meridian. So you can see that kind of diorama of the American pageant. Also, I think you can see places that look as if they have a natural setting and things that are sort of unnatural. They might be dried up or isolated, and I could give you illustrations, but essentially any place that's on a lake or a river, you can see that is sort of a strategic highlands for the long run.
Deborah, I'm sorry.
In a more modern sense of some of the changes of the country recently, we were struck by quarries and prisons. That, you know, we know that there are quarries and we know that there are prisons, but it's surprising that they seem to be everywhere, or you see what happens to mountaintops. So it's the change in the natural topography that comes with modernity that is remarkable. And the number of prisons, often next to quarries, by the way, I'm not sure, I guess because they're out in the countryside, it's startling because they're so obvious. You can see the definition often in Pentagon shape and in the middle of nowhere with, you know, space in between, and it is kind of striking that you see firsthand so many prisons.
Yeah, and that's one of the problems with prisons, with guards attracting employees to these prisons, because they're out in the middle of nowhere. And you have to be a special person who wants to go out and live in the middle of nowhere, and sometimes they're not the right people to run these prisons, evidently. We've done a show about that. You write, Deb, that you landed in dozens of towns and cities, anticipating in each of them local stories that would organize themselves into some kind of composed narrative about the backbone and character of the region, and maybe beyond that to help explain the character of the country. Did that prove to be true?
I think it maybe did prove to be true. Certainly it proved to be true town by town, that when we went into these towns, into the towns, as Jim said, we didn't go in talking about current politics. We didn't right. ask about, do you like Trump? Did you like Obama? What about Hillary? We went in asking about the questions of what were the issues in these towns? What were the problems? How are you solving them? And the answers came just rushing out. It was very easy for people to talk about the narrative of their towns and who participated in the compromises of getting over, say, we need to improve our schools, or our libraries are struggling, or our downtown needs something. So you could see that people, you could see what people were concentrating on and how they were working together, and it felt like the organic story of the town was coming out through these conversations.
Do these towns and these regions have characters of their own, exclusive, unique characters of their own, or are they blended versions of a brand called America?
I think the answer is yes and yes.
Okay.
One of the important factors of any town is people having a very strong sense of place, of why this town is here, what kind of history it has, what is the story it is telling in modern time. Was it a cowboy town, and is that why the meatpacking industry is still here? Or is it a town on the lake, and what happened to fishing, and how does that look in our town now in the murals and in the school mascots, which may be called sailors, as was in my small town on Lake Erie? So that individuality and people's handle on what makes their town unique and how they go toward developing that town or addressing its issues or building it is the one yes. The other yes is that how many similarities we saw from place to place that started to define what the American spirit seems to be.
Which is...
In my most Pollyanna-ish but true way, we are a generous and inclusive people. We all started out, or nearly, as immigrants of some sort. And when we went from town to town, seeing how immigrants were embraced and included and seen as part of the fabric of the development of that town, that was impressive.
This is one of the things that comes out in this book, that when you drill down into the individual towns that make up this enormous country, what you have found is pretty much the antithesis of our politics. How do you explain that? And we'll get into this over the course of the hour, but how do you explain that we have this ranting and raving about putting up walls and caravans coming in of hordes of invaders, and we got to stop it? You go to these towns, the ones that are successful, they have embraced immigrants because they see them as the future and the way to elevate themselves.
So we can hold for the next round why this might be, but just to establish that the difference exists, it really was stunning to us cumulatively. We know what the national level discourse is on immigration and some other topics, and to see the difference between that in the local level, I'll just give one example of Dodge City, Kansas, where I'll use actually the example of Holland, Michigan,
home of 30 seconds.
Okay, so Betsy DeVos, home of Betsy DeVos in Michigan. It's a town that has gone from being mainly Dutch immigrant to mainly Latino now for the farming economy, and even though most of the school population now is non-white children, the politically conservative, mainly white, mainly Dutch evangelical voters of Holland, Michigan voted school board issue to make sure that their schools were surviving in the long run.
Wow. We'll talk more about that because it's an important finding, I think. James and Deborah Fallows are here. Their book is called Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America. We'll continue in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. James and Deborah Fallows are with us. They have written a book, which came out in the spring, I believe, called Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America. They're here thanks to UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute, where they appeared last night at an event. I tried to count the number of cities that you went, and every time I counted, I came up with a different number. So I want to hear from you how many cities and towns you visited in the course of the 4 years for this book.
Probably overall, we visited about 50 towns.
And, wow.
And we ended up really visiting for long periods of time, for a week, for 2 weeks, maybe going back for a third week, about half that many. And we ended up writing about maybe 25 towns.
And some of these are small towns. So what did you do for 2 to 3 weeks in these small
towns? Oh, gosh. We could have stayed for 4 or 5 weeks in some of these towns. Ajo, Arizona, who knew? 2,400 people, also a snowbird town in the middle of the Sonoran Desert. But it's in this isolated place, and yet it opens out to the desert country, to the Tohono O'odham Indian Reservation. It connects itself to Mexico, which is just 40 miles away. It looks back to its history as a copper mining town with the Anglos and the Hispanics and the Indians, mm-hmm. and tries to, once the mine failed, figure out how to look back on its history, use that as an asset, and reinvent itself in a way that will attract all of those tourists going to the Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument that's just next door to it, and bring itself back from a town that was just really on the brink after the mine closed and everybody left, to what it should be today as a town living, as a town located in the middle of a desert. Mm. We could have stayed there for a year. And in fact, some of the, this is an interesting extra story about the migration of young people who still all go to the cities, but this kind of reverse migration of going to places where they, smaller places where they feel they can have an impact and where they can change a town and have some sense of agency there. We ran into, about the time we arrived on our first visit, there was a young couple from New England, Boston area, who were taking a road trip, like Dinosaur encouraged, around the country with their dog. And they stopped in...
in their Toyota, probably.
Some beat-up car.
Yeah, in Ajo, the least likely people to have landed in Ajo. And 3 years later, they are still in Ajo.
Really?
They are part of a young wave of people who are opening stores and help building a conference center and bringing in kind of thriving small businesses and a sense of culture to that town. A new kind of pioneer wave.
How did you choose these places? Was it just throwing darts at a map, or did you have a method to your madness, or did one town lead to another?
I think all of those things. The way we got our initial sort of range is I did an item on the Atlantic's website about 5 years ago saying, tell us about why your town has an interesting saga, looking for smaller places, not normally in the media spotlight unless there was a disaster of some kind, in places that had some kind of challenge, mm-hmm. Factory closing or whatever else. And we got about 1,000 essays from people saying, come here, come here, come here. And so then over the course of time, we just were kind of feeling our way around the country. We wanted to be geographically representative, you know, every part of the country pretty much got to, racially representative, size representative. As it got colder in the wintertime, we tended to head south because it's not much fun to be outdoors doing reporting and flying these little planes when it's below zero. But so it was a kind of informed amateurism that made us think it couldn't be scientific, but we thought it was representative.
Because you mentioned Hickory, North Carolina.
Yeah. Yeah.
And WFHE is, they're listening to us on WFHE.
Greetings.
Hello, Hickory.
but you don't write about it. Yes. You write about Greenville, South Carolina. Why did you choose one over the other? Doggone it.
So, Deb, would you like to take this one?
Well, so we were heading to Greenville,
yes.
Right? And we had an engine problem.
Yeah.
So we landed in Hickory. I can't remember what the issue was with the airplane.
There's a spark plug that had failed or one of these. Something always happens. So.
Yeah. There's always something going on. And no, you're right. We did not spend much time in Hickory. I'm sorry. We should go back.
We will
go back.
All right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we plan to keep doing this. So this is just the beginning.
So let's talk about Greenville, because that there's a companion website to this book, which I went on yesterday, because there are no pictures in the book.
Yes.
But there are pictures on the website of some of the places that you visited, among them Greenville. And many of us in Charlotte and Hickory have been to Greenville. And I got to say, and I lived in Spartanburg for a while. A long time. It was only a couple of months, but it seemed like a long time. But Greenville is one of the stars in this book. If you just look at the pictures, it is clear that it's one of the stars in this book. And it is certainly one of the stars in the Carolinas. It is a fabulous town.
It is. And people in the Carolinas may not fully recognize Greenville is seen as a star in the world's eyes.
Really?
One of the problems for Greenville's managers now is that literally every day people are coming from Australia and from Germany and from California and from Brazil to say, how did Greenville do it? How do they have the combination of the downtown they do now? How do they go from what was 30 or 40 years ago an almost all mill economy, textile mills, which is just gone now, to having BMW and Michelin and all the rest there, and how they've dealt with their racial separations and burdens. And they just announced last week a new park that was going to be directly about some of Greenville's racial heritage. So Greenville is, we knew nothing about Greenville before we got there, and now we feel like it's, why doesn't everybody live in Greenville or Charlotte or other places?
No, I get it. The Greenville's beautiful. There's no question about it. And I learned something from you that I did not know. That one of the reasons Greenville is successful is because even when they were a mill town, they weren't dependent on one company. They had several different manufacturing facilities there, which they have now, because that's what they've diversified their economy, whereas Spartanburg depended on one company. They were a company town, essentially, and never diversified to this day, except for maybe Hardee's.
And I think part of Greenville's success, too, is another answer to what you were saying of how important are these towns unique and how important is it that they recognize that. You could point to a couple examples in Greenville of how they worked on their school system, and the industrial community, BMW, GM, Michelin, worked with the school system to create and invent a different type of school in that town. They went into one of the most distressed areas of town, and with the help of the engineers in these companies, built a school called the A.J. Wittenberg Elementary School of Engineering. So they've got these little bitty kids who, through the help with the curriculum of focusing on engineering and the volunteers who go into that school, are shaping these kids into a tech-familiar upbringing, who will eventually go on and be part of an important workforce in the town. So it's good for the kids, it's good for the companies, it's good for the texture of the town. It wouldn't work in every town, but it works in Greenville.
You can go online and find these pictures of not just Greenville, but some of the other towns. It's called OurTownsBook.com, OurTownsBook.com. And I wanted to ask about that, because you just mentioned that school in Greenville. And there are examples of things like that going on in these small towns all over America, where they're trying to do something that gives them a sense of place, that differentiates themselves from other small towns, that gives them a purpose, a reason for being, and for people to come and live there and build families, etc. Are they spitting into the wind, or is it working?
Both and both. One difference in Debs and my approach to the world, as you may have, listeners may have inferred over the past.
She's warm and fuzzy, you know.
she is more, this is all going great. And I'm more on the many places it's going great.
Okay.
And there are some. So it is true simultaneously that there's some small towns that are just fighting headwinds too great for them to survive. And certainly people have seen that in the Middle South and in the Great Plains regions. You see it where places that a century ago had a kind of economic logic, and the way farming has evolved just makes it too hard to hang on. But simultaneously, many more places than thought they could make it 20 or 30 years ago now seem to be finding ways at a scale of 10,000 or 20,000 or 30,000 to say, we can attract people to come here. We have specialized industries that can take advantage of our location, our water, our resources. We can make ourselves into tourist places. We can be part, we can have our connections to cities like Charlotte or whatever else. So we think some cities, it's just too hard, but a lot of them are finding ways to go ahead.
Some of these places don't look so great that I've seen the pictures of and that you visited, despite the fact that they are trying really hard. Yeah. They got a ways to go. They got a lot of work to do, and they're all in various stages of coming into the 21st century and finding a new reason for being. But we have a most people have a conception, because we've talked about it, and the media has put this out, that small-town America is desolate, it's over, that the main streets have closed up shop, Walmarts have taken over where there are Walmarts, and now that they're going away, in many cases, there's absolutely nothing to keep young people there or to attract them back once they leave for college. You found a slightly different story. Is it slightly different, or is are our preconceptions just completely wrong?
So I think that our preconceptions are more wrong than people think. And here will be an example. I'll have an extreme example. New York Magazine about a month ago had an article that was, in its Brooklyn way, lamenting how similar small towns had become, and all having a nice coffee shop, and all having a nice brew pub, and all having nice, interesting stores downtown, and all having nice downtown residents. And the New York Magazine person was saying, oh, this is so familiar and tedious. Couldn't they be more inventive? I was thinking, way better than Applebee's, way better than other chain restaurants, and a sign of how this idea of what an approachable small town is like is becoming more widespread. A lot of small towns still have their old 19th century architecture that can be, rehabilitated. So a lot of places thousands of places are applying this model of making themselves more attractive, more livable, more viable.
And is this happening if you look at the national media, we don't talk about this. The national media doesn't talk about this. They talk about the overarching political story of our time, whatever it may be. So if you're living in a small town, are you living in a silo? Are you aware that what you're doing, other towns are trying to do? Maybe they're doing it a little differently. Maybe they're succeeding where you're failing and you might be able to learn something from them, or they from you, but you're siloed and you don't communicate. Is it happening that way, or are they communicating?
Again, I hate to keep saying yes and yes, but but it is yes. There is a sense often that we run into in these towns that, are we the only ones doing this? Like with the libraries, they call themselves the best kept secret in town when they're all trying to expand and be creative and so forth, but they don't know about the town next door that's doing the same thing, or they don't hear about it. We tend to hear about every other little town if there's a tornado, if there's a shooting, if there's a caucus, and then the press comes and the press goes, and that's all that you know about it. And it's hard for little towns to get to know each other, and it takes a deliberate effort. So I think there is a problem of feeling, are we alone out there?
Yeah. I want to talk about libraries for just a second, because we live in the 21st century. Everything's online. We have Google. Who needs a reference library? Just ask Google, or ask Alexa, or ask whoever, Siri. You say that libraries are the center, the heartbeat of nearly every community you visited. And during the economic downturn, this city started cutting back on things because money stopped coming in. So they cut back on cutting the grass and servicing the parks. They cut the hours at the library. They shut some branches down. And inevitably, the only thing people complained about was the library.
Yeah.
Explain that.
It is an amazing phenomenon in America, I guess starting back in the Carnegie days when they spread out everywhere. Librarians are a special breed of people. They're there to serve the people. And the ethic that grows out of libraries is that they are there to fill in the gaps, to recognize the wants and the needs of the community, and to really attack those to fix things. So you've got, if education is struggling, the libraries will step up and do pre-reading, pre-K efforts for all of the children. Every director of the library that I went to, when I said, what's the most important thing you're doing? They would say, it's the children. It's all about the children. And the children's wing was the first thing to develop. In terms of technology, 25% of the country doesn't have fast Wi-Fi at home. Almost every library does have fast Wi-Fi. People go there to read the paper, to get help with looking for jobs online, to research a spot they might have on their arm, and they can't afford to go to the doctor, and they'll look with the help of the librarian. Is this serious? Is this something I should do anything about? So having that access to technology is important, and also the sense, the civic sense of what happens in towns. When you've got people who don't speak English, you can go to the library for free in many places and get ESL classes or citizenship classes. You can learn how to read. Adult literacy programs are hugely important in libraries, and it's actually a whole lot of fun. In our library in D.C., on a Saturday afternoon in the main hall, there'll be 70 people doing the tango. I go to my library to do yoga. You can get a latte there. It's the technology, the education, and the civic and social sense of what's happening in this town is filling in what towns can no longer normally afford, and being a leader towards setting that table.
I don't think we qualify for your book, but because we're a big small town,
too big and famous and shiny.
But you need to walk exactly two blocks down the street this way and go to the children's library to imagine on, just to see what they've done there with our children's library. Getting back to being siloed, the national conversation, if you look at the election polls, the pre-election polls, a majority of people thought the country was headed in the wrong direction. But when you go to these small towns, that's not what they're thinking. Their lives, they're pretty happy with. Is that right?
So opinion polls show something that we have asserted, which is that over the last generation, people's sense of the course of the country has been getting darker and darker and darker. But by about a 3-to-1 margin, Americans right now feel their own communities are headed in the right direction. And that's partly people self-selecting, but it's not entirely that. It's people feeling as if they have traction, they have connection, they can make reasonable compromises, they can make long-term plans. I can say 20 years from now, we'd like the city to be this way and be moving in that direction. So that is a much more widespread phenomenon than you might guess.
We've heard a lot in the last couple of years, because people run for election constantly now, about the urban-rural divide, and that's the left-right divide in this country pretty much. If you're in an urban area, you're a Democrat, or you're a progressive, or you're a leftist. If you're in the country, you're a conservative, you're a Republican. Is that necessarily true? I want to get an answer to that. Do we really have different values depending upon where we live, or is there a commonality that is being overlooked because of the way the political conversation is being driven? You don't want to talk about politics, so just touch on that when we come back with James and Deborah Fallows. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are very pleased to have James and Deborah Fallows with us today. They have a book called Our Towns, a 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America. They spent 4 years flying into and out of small towns across the country, asking questions, getting to know people, getting to know what works, what doesn't work, what makes America tick. And before I ask another question, let me just get a comment here from Tim on Facebook, who says, Mike, you need to get back to Spartanburg. The transformation is remarkable, as housing has become unaffordable in Greenville, people are looking to Spartanburg. Also, love your journalism, Mr. Fallows.
Say thanks very much, and we want to get back to Spartanburg, Greenville, and Greer again.
Went to Greer, and that's 15 minutes away from both of those towns, because Spartanburg's on one side, Greenville's on the other, and Greer's in the middle, and that's where the BMW plant
is.
Exactly,
and the airport.
Okay, that's why you went to Greer. Okay, I was going to ask you. Did you go to Spartanburg?
We did go to Spartanburg.
Did you go to the Beacon Drive-In?
No, we did not. We did not. We were careful in our book not to write about places we felt we didn't know enough to say very much about. Okay. So we will go back for a fuller immersion in Spartanburg.
Okay. So we've heard a great deal about this urban-rural divide and our politics, and the coasts have one set of values, and flyover country, where you actually landed, has a different set of values. Did you find that to be true? Do they have different values? Do they see the world or the country differently? Can we get along?
to start at the back, we certainly can get along. And there was a fascinating article in the, just this past couple days, this past Sunday in the Washington Post by a man named Jeffrey Cabaservice, who's a sort of known historian and academic, who was saying that he thought that he's from sort of interior America himself. And he used our book as one of many illustrations, plus midterm election results, to say that there are common concerns across the country. People want to have decent communities. They have a certain inclusiveness and a certain willingness to be reasonable. And he thought, as we do, that just the dynamics of national politics and the national media have made things seem much more polarized at the national level than the way people live day by day.
Who's driving that? The politicians? The media? Both?
I think both, in a sort of destructive spiral over the past generation, where both media organizations and some politicians have found it useful to play to the extremes and say, there is the enemy. In most of the small towns we were in, of course, there were enemies and all that, but the political discourse was saying, how can we make some kind of agreement because we all have to live here? Yeah. And somehow that sensibility in the national discourse has been somewhat lost.
And another interesting aspect of that is what makes rural and what makes urban. One comment we heard from people in towns of all sizes. So we were in towns as small as 1,400 people in Eastport, Maine, and as big as Columbus, Ohio, or Pittsburgh, which are sizable towns.
Or Fresno.
Yeah, and towns in between, 25,000, 60,000. In nearly every town we went, people would say, our town is the perfect size, whether it was Columbus or Eastport. And what they meant, what they went on to say, was that it's big enough that there are a lot of things going on here. It's small enough that I can have an impact on what's going on in my town. Mm-hmm. And what they meant by that was collaboration, that they knew people, that they were accountable to each other, and that they could work together. So even in big towns, even in tiny towns, there was this way of operating and this mindset that we go forth together in our place.
You live in D.C.
We do.
Okay. And you fly out of the Gaithersburg Airport,
yes,
which is north of Washington. It's north of Rockville, Maryland. And when I lived there, Gaithersburg was a small town. It was kind of not, you had to want to go to Gaithersburg. And now it's just part of the megalopolis of D.C. So you live there. Do you understand these people in small towns who say our town's the perfect size? Because you live in this enormous place that's just nothing but traffic.
Okay. I grew up in Vermilion, Ohio.
Okay.
Town of 10,000 on Lake Erie. So I have a duckling imprint for 18 years of what it means to be in a small town. And we go back there again. Jim, same thing.
I grew up in Redlands, California, about 30,000 people when I was growing up there. It's right next to San Bernardino, which is bigger but has a very distinct identity too. And we have lived over the last 40 years since we first came to D.C. We've lived about half the time elsewhere, either overseas reporting or on the West Coast or in Texas or whatever. So we think we are still our little neighborhood in D.C. is where we raised our children. We have lots of very close friends there. So we think of it as a neighborhood, but also we've seen other parts of the country.
Let's talk about inclusivity, because you write about that a lot. And it's the antithesis of what we are coming to understand people want, because we hear from the president, we need to build a wall. We need to end cooperative arrangements, put ourselves first, close our doors. You didn't find that. You found that the towns that opened their doors are thriving. If they understand that at that level in those towns that make up America, why don't we understand that on a broader national level?
That is a hard question that I don't know the real answer to. I'll give you a couple of symptoms. Polling results clearly show the parts of the U.S. that are most concerned about immigrants are the ones where the immigrants aren't. That it's like, for example, Steve King's district in Iowa is about 97% white, and he's been the leader of the sort of anti-immigrant fear in most of California, in Arizona, in Texas, with the exception of Joe Arpaio. You know, George W. Bush became governor of Texas essentially with an inclusive message, and he was very popular among the Latino voters of Texas. And we found lots of cities in the Midwest and the Plain States where the ethnic balance has changed dramatically from mainly Anglo to mainly Latino in the past generation, where the leadership of the town, still historically Anglo, thinks this is our future. We're going to find a way to make this future work. So that seems to be possible where people know each other directly and something's different at the national
and,
level.
And this is not just happening with Hispanic immigrants. It's happening with people who come here from all over the world and from refugee communities, which are scattered all over the United States, where people have no association with our culture or our language or our history. And yet, these towns are making this work.
You can talk about either Sioux Falls or Erie on that
front. Yeah, we spent a lot of time in Sioux Falls, in Erie, Pennsylvania, and in Burlington, Vermont. All of those cities have towns have sizable proportions of refugees. In maybe one of the most dramatic is Sioux Falls. You think of it as its history as a Nordic place, as a Germanic place. That's where people came from, but it has also taken refugees, starting with the churches. Lutheran services, the Catholic charities, refugee agencies that began taking refugees in the Vietnam War, and it has played out until the most recent refugees, the Somalis, the Syrians, the Sudanese. They are looking more different. They are getting blacker and blacker. Their cultures are more different. And yet, as these towns have evolved taking the refugees, the vocabulary that you hear from them is, we are better for this. We are a stronger town for this.
And they don't have incidences of hate crimes the Klan popping up here and there?
Sure, especially in the last year and a half. Mm-hmm. But it has been, there's been community reaction to those. And just a very short illustration of this, many of your listeners will have heard 2 or 3 weeks ago when the polling place in Dodge City, Kansas, was moved north of town, it was harder for the mainly Latino voters to get there. That was done by the state government under Chris Kobach. The city council in Dodge City, mainly older white people, voted immediately to provide door-to-door transportation to the polling places for everybody there. And they put out a statement saying, we are proud of what Dodge City is becoming.
Right.
And by that, they meant a majority Latino community.
Kobach lost, right?
He did, yes. Mm-hmm.
You write about another hopeful trend that's happening in small towns around America, and that is people coming home, people returning to these small towns after they leave for whatever reason. What's driving them back? What's attracting them? What's the magnet?
Well, there are a number of things. Certainly affordability is one of them. A town like Fresno, California, you've got a lot of people who were in Silicon Valley. It became, they were technical people, they were artistic people, and found that it was very difficult to afford to live there. And as they went back to Fresno, maybe because they grew up there or because they could afford to live there, you find a critical mass of either returnees or people staying there who can create this life balance of, hey, I can live here, I can do my passion, whether it's art, and I can have a day job. It makes for a more well-rounded, well-balanced life. Certainly, we found that among the, quote, the young people who were starting out and going to towns like Columbus, which has a thriving art scene, a thriving fashion scene, a big university, a startup culture, or Pittsburgh, or Charleston, West Virginia. A lot of times it was family reasons, but it was generally a sense of, I can make a better life balance here.
But we keep being told that young people, particularly millennials, want to live in urban settings where they don't have to have a car, where they can walk everywhere and be with their friends every night and go to breweries. We're going to talk about breweries in a second. how does that jibe with the fact that they're moving back to these small towns?
So in this way, there are some people who want to live in New York or in San Francisco, and that migration goes on. But smaller places are making themselves more like what younger people are looking for. For example, Allentown, PA, is they have a real downtown revival there. A tech company's moving back downtown because their employees wanted to live downtown. And so there's a much they've had a big downtown redevelopment project with second and third floor residential for both younger people and retirees. So smaller towns are developing some of these traits of urban life that younger people want.
So some of these towns had a previous life with different industry, like mining or manufacturing, that has gone the way of the dinosaurs. It's not coming back. I don't care what they say, it is not coming back. But different kinds of manufacturing are coming in, and different industries like high tech are coming in, which is attracting younger people and making it attractive for them to stay or to come back home. What does that do to the older people who lost those jobs in those original industries? Do these two generations have different views of small-town America?
I'm sure they do, and what I learned by studying American history in college long ago and reading about it ever since is that through our entire existence, every decade there's been some huge industrial dislocation. There have always been people in the United States who, when they reach age 50, 55, 60, and they lose their economic footing, they don't ever really recover. This is the saga of moving off the farm. It's the saga of the big steel mills changing. So the challenge for the United States has been finding the right kind of continuing engagement for people who just are dislocated and making a different world for their children. That's been the historical pattern. So people, of course, see things differently of different generations. But I think that the hope of new industries is something that many towns are placing their faith in.
So we live in the South, not Milwaukee, where there are traditions of beer. And St. Louis even has a tradition of beer. But we live in the South. And suddenly, all these breweries started popping up around North Carolina, and particularly in Charlotte. You can't go a block without running into a brew pub or a brewery itself. This is not particular to Charlotte. This is evidently happening everywhere. What's up with that?
Well, I will give you the person who is the unacknowledged hero of the craft brewing movement in the United States is my one-time employer, Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter deregulated brewing in the late 1970s, and that was what made this boom possible. And so the U.S. went from having only a couple dozen breweries after Prohibition, big industrial ones, to having 7,000 or 8,000 now. And this is how it was back in the mid-1800s, where every town had its own brewery because there was no refrigeration. It's become a real manufacturing industry. It's become a real tool of sort of urban renewal. Right. It's become a good thing.
You have a chapter in the book called 10 and a Half Signs of Civic Success, and that's the half sign.
It is.
In fact, if you have a brewery or breweries, you got one of the things. The others are, I'm sorry?
I was going to say that the breweries are, in a way, challenging libraries. We were back in Duluth, Minnesota, visiting a brewery we had seen several years ago, and that brew pub now has a children's section, so families can come and the kids can play while the folks eat and drink beer. And it has a back room where the day we were there, there was a civic club meeting going on in the brewery. So it has become a kind of civic center as well.
Some of the other things, the 10 signs of civic success, I was going through the list, and Charlotte pretty much checks them off. People working together on local possibilities, the public-private partnerships. You can pick out local patriots. We certainly have that. People know the civic story. They have downtowns, these successful places. They have a research university. They have and care about community college, which we have. They have distinctive, innovative schools. I think we have that. They make themselves open. I think we've done that. And they have big plans. We certainly have that going. So we check out all of those. You wrote in The Atlantic, James, I only have a minute and a half, that these trips changed your mind about what really matters. What really matters?
What really matters to America now, I think, is recognizing there's a struggle for our identity and our future. There is the poison of national political discourse, which we all are affected by, and there's the renewal, the health, the possibility, the connections of what people are doing city by city in thousands of places across the United States. So we hope that the renewing forces are the ones that are the buoying up future of the country, and we're going to do our best to tell those stories and connect those people.
We only have 30 seconds, but you're both in the media. How can the media help?
Jim, you are really in the media, and you've thought about this a lot more than I have, so I think
you've got 20 seconds. Yeah.
Okay, so number one, finding ways to tell positive stories that are not sappy, and that's a real challenge. And number two, recognizing that local media are sort of canaries in the mine shaft, to use the cliche, and finding ways to support local media, which are so important.
Subscribe to the paper or the website or whatever.
And both, yes.
Give it to public radio and give often. Our Town's 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America by James and Deborah Fallows. Thank you so much for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.